Hello and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. I'm your host, Liz Kay, and I'm joined by producer Chris Judge of the class of 2005. Here at the Providence College Podcast, we bring you interesting stories from the Fryer family. This week, many Americans are thinking a lot about food as we get ready to celebrate Thanksgiving. So it's a great time to talk with Dr. Alex Orkiza, an assistant professor of history. He teaches in PC's Department of History and Classics and the American Studies program, as well as the Development of Western Civilization, aka CIV. He co-teaches a CIV colloquium called DWC Through Food and recently published a book, Taste of Control, Food and the Filipino Colonial Mentality Under American Rule. The book describes how American colonizers tried to shape the way Filipinos ate, cooked, and thought about the food from their country in the early 1900s. Dr. Orkiza, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Liz.
So I have to admit, I've been so curious about your DWC colloquium ever since I first heard about it. Could you tell us a little bit about what CIV colloquia are all about and what inspired you and Dr. Jensen to offer it?
Absolutely. So the CIV colloquia is the fourth of four classes over the course of 2 years or four semesters at PC. And it's a chance for rising juniors in their second semester of their sophomore year to choose a specialized focus of study over the course of 15 weeks that integrates all the concepts they've learned for the last three semesters in history and philosophy and theology and then literature. And Dr. Jensen and I came up with an idea actually over a couple of rounds of beer that the perfect way of integrating all of this history and all of these stories of human evolution and change and the exchange of cultures is through food. And we teach a course called DWC in Food, where Dr. Jensen, as a scholar of Nietzsche and philosophy, and specifically moral philosophy of after the Enlightenment, brings in his expertise, and I bring in my expertise as an American historian, an historian of American immigration and American empire, and tell all of these different stories that you think aren't related, but truly are, because food is the one thing that we all share as people, right? We all eat three square meals a day if we're lucky. We all experience different food trends that come and go. And it's the one unifying thing that we all share. So if we could use that as the common object in order to understand how we're living our lives, then you can examine the way that we're living our lives in so many different ways and do all kinds of really cool comparisons and all kinds of really cool historical stories of the ways that these food trends are shaping and evolving and shaping our lives.
I was going to say, I mean, I feel like I've heard arguments that we wouldn't have civilization if it were not for the cultivation of food, you know, that farming allowed people to have spare time to have art and literature and music, you know, if you know, when we moved from being hunter-gatherers to and nomads to people who could stay in one place, we had evenings to fill with.
Absolutely. Once we were able to establish stable crops or a sense of agriculture or system of agriculture, then we could start to develop all the things that make a civilization and all the things that make a society. And then, and one of the ways that one of the drivers of making those societies is making sure that those food sources remain stable and remain abundant. And the way that you parcel out things like land ownership or things like the development of cities is based on whether or not people are healthy. And the way that they stay healthy, arguably, is making sure that there's a high nutritional level and making sure that they have ready access to a food source. I should probably also mention too that the cool thing about this course is that Anthony, Dr. Jensen, is also a certified oniologist. He's like two levels below like a sommelier that should be working at a restaurant. And he's almost one level below that too, because he's about to get like the next certification. So we're talking with someone that like really knows his wine in Dr. Jensen. And before I became an historian and before I went to graduate school, I worked as a chef in San Francisco, and I have a culinary degree from the French Culinary Institute in New York. So for both of us, like food isn't just something that we dabble in, it's stuff that it shapes the way that we look at the world and the way that we study our world. Anthony is always working in comparisons of French versus American wines and how they evolved because of the way that we experience patterns of migration and the Industrial Revolution. the way that the French reacted to the French Revolution and the ways that different kinds of colonies and states emerged in France directly affects the way that they cultivate grapes. And the ways that that these wines were exported around the world are a reaction to the Second Napoleonic Revolution and the economic trends in France. Like, that's the kind of stuff that Anthony is looking at. And me as an American historian, I'm constantly thinking about how something like the progressive movement influenced our understanding of food laws and food nutrition and making sure that we don't have adulterated foods, or something like the first and second waves of immigration in the United States affect things like the labor source and the labor that's available for agriculture in California in the 1920s and the 1930s, and led to something like my book, where we're talking a lot about Filipino migrant laborers in the United States working in the 1930s, while the United States is also ruling the Philippines as a colony. So yeah, food unites all of these things. Some other things that we talk about as well, how specific food items like corn or rice or butter or ice cream are all dependent on things like labor, human migration, trade, and market economies. And one of the things that I really like to delve in this course is a deep dive into the historical memory that's contained in food. So if you turn on the Food Network and you watch those barbecue shows, I think Netflix has one now as well, that's just like a deep dive into barbecue. They talk a lot about like the regional cuisine that's available in the American South and how different kinds of barbecues are made in different parts of the country. But they also leave out a lot of the stories of how we made those into the recipes that we know today. They leave out the slave labor that's behind a lot of the ways that these foods are developed. They leave out the historical patterns of migration that go into the American South and the people that are actually landowners and slaveholders in the American South. A lot of the American South is run by people that came from Scotland. And you could see a lot of the smoking techniques that are popular in Scottish cookery make their way into barbecue techniques in the American South. So like you can actually map along how barbecue and American, the memories of the American South are embedded in a way that is easy for us to consume, but actually writes out a lot of like the messy bits of American history, the exploitation, the labor, the slavery, and the market forces that really underpin the original American sin. So while food is something that's really fun to hear about, if you really delve into it, it uncovers a lot of the stories that we don't want to talk about in history.
And so much of our food has become such an element of our pop culture now, but yeah, as you say, we're just glossing over so much of it, right? You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm as guilty as the next person of finding recipes on Pinterest or Instagram. But if you look at some Instagram accounts, there's a thriving sub-discipline now of food history that actually like starts to untangle a lot of these stories. And I think it's the next really interesting subgenre for the humanities and diving into how the world has emerged today. I think food just makes all these stories much more tangible.
So with the background that Dr. Jensen and you both have, are you able to do some more kind of intriguing things in the classroom? Are you able to do cooking demonstrations? I'm guessing as second semester sophomores, you're not doing a lot of wine tastings, but.
Yeah, we talked with the legal department at the college. They said, thanks, but no thanks. Can't do the wine stuff, but we've been able to approximate it in certain ways. So Dr. Jensen prints out a wine taster's card for like, you know, a rubric of 10 different things you're grading for when you're judging a wine. And we don't tell students when we start this that they'll be doing a taste test, but it doesn't involve wine. It involves different kinds of grape juice. So we build up the skills for them to do wine tasting with a non-alcoholic beverage. So Dr. Jensen definitely does the wine bit. Me as a cook and as a former chef, I've done a couple of cooking demonstrations in the time before COVID. It's actually really, really fun to try and not set off the fire alarm in the second floor of Ruane. So we always have a student that's by the fire alarms, like waving to make sure the smoke detector doesn't go off, and we open up all the windows. But yeah, we made some stuff. Like the very first class of the semester, I like to do a demonstration of how to make an omelet, because as a classically French, as a trained, as a, sorry, I'm trying, what's the order of words? here. As someone that was trained in classical French cuisine, the way that you cook an egg represents your respect for the technique. And for cooking an omelet, it seems really basic, but it's really easy to screw up. So I use that as an entry point into the different rules and regulations, the different techniques that are involved in classical French cuisine, and how all of that emerged after the Enlightenment, when the French cooks after the Second Napoleonic Revolution were traveling around the world and popularizing this one cuisine by using one cookbook that spelled out all these rules. And I present that source in its original French and translate it out for the students to see how what looks like a treatise on like Newton's rules of thermodynamics are actually like a recipe for how to make omelets in the 18th century in France. So I always do the omelet demonstration to open the class. I like to do a shucking oysters demonstration because it's New England and oysters here are fantastic, but also as a way of leading into the discussion of what are American restaurants. The very first American restaurants in the United States appear across the docksides in New York City. And they're really just like oyster stands. So knowing that oysters are the birth of this way that we all dine publicly now, helps them understand that this was something that came back in the 1820s and the 1830s. That was a direct result of a laboring class that needed a quick, cheap supply of food that was available when they weren't building ships because they had to get back to work. As a former chef, I think it's really, really important that they know basic knife technique and understand that if you know how to use a knife, then you could cook just about everything. So I always do like the basic knife technique demos with all the brunoises and chinoises and all the different kinds of cuts. Always do this thing, you know, keep your thumb behind your second and third finger and guide across the cutting board. But whenever I do that, I show them that all these-
Make sure you still-
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Make sure that you have a honing steel to keep your knives sharp and straight. But I use the French terminology for all these different cuts that seem like, you know, highfalutin, but use it to describe the cuts that are used to make a salsa, because it's essentially the same kind of technique. And then I use the same ingredients plus two other new ingredients to make a Vietnamese sauce called Nuoc Cham. So it's, you add a little bit of sugar and a little bit of fish sauce, and then make the fish sauce connection back to basically the first semester of Civ to an ingredient called garum, which is fermented fish paste that the ancient Romans used to flavor their food as well. And just try and like blow up this idea that like all of this is the domain of specific cuisines. There's really just a much larger exchange that's in there. And once you know the techniques, you can start mixing and matching and understand like how all these ingredients cross across.
It's so interesting that the ancient these ancient societies all the way to today, we've got different ways to incorporate that umami flavor, right? With fermented fish. It's not just something you would find in an Asian cuisine, but even,
right,
you know, I guess anchovies and Caesar salad, right? This is that umami flavor.
Right. Anthony likes to, because he was the director of the PC in Rome project or PC in Rome program. He demonstrates cacio e pepe, which is like three ingredients. It's pasta water, cheese and pepper. And he shows that, you know, the simplicity of three ingredients and doing and elevating them well and maximizing their tastes results in a dish that is like classically Roman. So like we spend a lot of time building up like, look at all these rules that are involved in the Enlightenment and French cuisine. And that thing says like, but the Italians are doing it differently. You just make sure that it's like simple ingredients that speak well. And before the pandemic happened, I was really hoping to cook the dish of that I cook every Sunday. It's a dish called adobo. It's like the Philippine national dish, a combination of vinegar, soy sauce, bay leaf, garlic, pepper, a little bit of sugar and soy sauce. And you throw in the protein of your choice and you cook it the way that you want to during the day. So some days I'll put in pork, some days I'll put in chicken. And the idea is that the vinegar helps preserve a protein from degrading too quickly in a tropical climate and then age before refrigeration. And it's that kind of ingenuity and basically making a quick pickle that happens to involve a protein that you cook in a very short amount of time because it's really hot in Southeast Asia. It gives you the sense of the ingenuity and the adaptability of all these ingredients for the location and for the population that they're serving. And we do that across cultures in this course. We look very closely at Nigerian cuisine. We look closely at Southeast Asian cuisines. Anthony did a deep dive as well into as he calls it, Western American cuisine, otherwise known as urban cuisine, because he's from Wisconsin. So we take a look at the different kinds of sausages that are made in his home state of Wisconsin. And as a Bay Area native from Northern California, my argument that American cuisine, what makes American cuisine is that it borrows from different cultures in a way that only the U.S. can. It's a lot like why I think the American soccer team should be much better than it is. You have all of these different styles of play that should come together in a way that you can only do in the United States. And all these different flavors are coming in a way that could only happen in the United States.
You've mentioned a lot about your class pre-COVID, pre-pandemic. How did your class adapt, and how was that transition for you when students returned to classes after spring break?
We're all trying our best right now, right? We're all trying our best to make sure that the ship is running. And we kept the class going. Obviously, we had to ditch a bunch of the stuff that we wanted to prioritize, like the cooking demonstrations and sharing stuff with students. We continued the cooking demonstrations at home, just moved our laptops to our ranges and stuff. But the students couldn't taste the food, which is kind of a bummer. That was part of the thing that we were looking forward to the most. But we retooled pretty quickly. Like, we made sure that we were able to continue our synchronous teaching. At the same time, I'm not going to mitigate that there were challenges along the way. My wife is a physician at Boston Medical Center, and she's an essential worker. So she was gone on Tuesdays and Thursdays when I'm teaching. So Dr. Jensen was able to pick up the majority of running seminar because I couldn't with a toddler running around. But I recorded all of my lectures. So I finished childcare, taking care of my kid at 7:30, and then would record lectures until 11 o'clock at night. So that was challenging. But I feel like that experience definitely gave me empathy into understanding that students are facing the same kinds of challenges. And with that mindset, that we're all adapting, that we're all trying to our best. And the thing that we've lost is that sense of being in the classroom together and that sense of humanity. The thing that I'm trying to do the most now is to make sure that the procedural work of teaching, assessments and Zoom recording and posting lectures online and PowerPoints, that doesn't get in the way of the human connections that are key to learning. So I've tried my best since then to maximize the amount of interaction that I have with students, not only on Zoom during class time, but to let them know that I'm available for office hours after I put my kids down, which actually works really well for a lot of students because they're night owls. So I have a sign-up sheet and tell them, if you want to get in touch with me after 8 o'clock, let me know. And I have really busy office hours from 9 to 11:30.
Definitely non-traditional. I don't know if you would have office hours in your on-campus office from 8 to 11, but you know, this remote thing, there may be some silver linings, like you said. You know.
Yeah. And I've actually enjoyed being able to, on a couple of classes, walk around the house and show them, you know, like book collections. Students are always like fascinated by like our private lives as professors outside of the classroom. So I show them like what the bookcase is like, and they always expect it to be full of like history monographs. And instead they see all these cookbooks. They see a bunch of literature that I read that I can't let go of when I was in college myself, you know, 20 years ago. And they see all the children's books that I'm reading my kids. And they ask me, why am I reading those books? And the fact that there's actually like a thoughtful answer for like why I'm choosing certain children's books, and most likely there's an historical rationale, they just kind of laugh. They're like, yeah, you're that special kind of nerd. History is embedded in all of your thinking.
Oh, and you mentioned that you have been able to incorporate some of your research into your DWC colloquia. Can you tell us what drew you to that area of research? How did you?
Yeah, this is a fun one. it's an intersection of like a bunch of stuff that it had always been important to me. And I like to think of like the book, my research, as like an integration of like immigration, American identity, and food as history. So I'm the kid of immigrants. My parents immigrated from the Philippines in the 1970s and settled in California, where I grew up. But they're also the result of the Immigration Act of 1965, where large numbers of Americans were coming in, new Americans were coming in that were high skilled immigrants, and flipped the percentage of immigrants that were coming from Europe versus those that were coming from Asia and Latin America. My parents were one of those. They're Filipinos. We're now the third largest immigrant group in the United States. And growing up in a Filipino-American household, in a place that was super populated with Filipino-Americans, I always wondered why there weren't more Filipino restaurants. So there weren't that many Filipino restaurants when I was growing up in the Bay Area. And for a population that was that large, I always wondered why that was the case. And as an historian, I always think about this stuff in terms of the past. And that's where the book came along. There had to be an answer for why there weren't that many Filipino restaurants. And I argue that it's the result of the way that Americans were teaching Filipinos for a long time to think about their food. And was to think of it as something that was inferior, something to move away from, something that needed to be replaced by something that was better, which was the American way of cooking in the early 20th century. The importation of domestic science, ways of thinking about American nutrition and American cookbooks, all that stuff is coming into the Philippines and the not that distant future or the not that distant past. It's like my great grandparents' generation. And I actually did a little bit of research into this when I was doing research on the book. My great grandfather was himself a teacher, educated in the 1870s and the 1880s during the Spanish period. And then when he had to start teaching an American in the American system, he was teaching a lot of the stuff that I write about in the book, which is an American way of growing food, an American way of cooking, an American way of thinking about nutrition, and an American way of looking at recipes. There was a minimization of Filipino food and Filipino cuisine in this time period. So it was only natural that when my parents immigrated in the 1960s and 1970s, they would be the inheritors of a long tradition of not thinking with pride about Filipino cuisine for the better part of 50 years.
Can we give our listeners a quick primer if they're not intimately familiar with the details of like the relationship with the Philippines and the United States? So it was late 1890s when the Spanish colonization ended and American colonization began, right? 1898?
Sure thing. 1898, very good. So the Spanish-American War, which we learn in a lot of our American history textbooks, is the Remember the Maine and Cuba, also results in the acquisition of the Philippines from the Spanish government for the price of $20 million. So the Philippines is essentially bought from Spain by the United States in 1898. And then what follows after that is 4 years of Filipinos trying to fight for their independence from the Americans and the resulting Philippine-American War. And some historians estimate that 1 in 8 Filipinos were killed during this time period, that they were casualties of essentially like an American war to suppress independence. So when that finally ends in 1904, the US controls the Philippines up until 1946, with the exception of World War II. So for 1942 until 1945, the Japanese are controlling the Philippines. So it's one of these things that got me into academia in the first place. Like every textbook that I read in high school in the 1990s in California, which I considered a progressive place, minimized the fact that the US had an empire in the Philippines, the country that my parents are from. And the more I dug into like why this was happening when I got to college, a couple of different facets emerged. The US wanted to become an empire and play in the game of empire alongside its peers in Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands. The US wanted to open up a trade channel and an entrepot into Asia, specifically with the developing our markets in China and Japan. And the Philippines was the easy place to do it. And the part that jumped out to me the most was that while the U.S. was controlling and ruling the Philippines, so much of the focus in creating this new colony was in trying to replicate the United States in an American image in the Philippines. So you would have the elevation of American cuisine in the Philippines. You would have the outlawing of speaking Filipino in the public schools for about 20 years, where English was the only language of instruction. It was actually forbidden to fly the Filipino flag for a while. You could only fly the American flag. And oddly, a justification that the United States needed to Christianize the Philippines when the Philippines is, last time I checked, 88% Catholic country. So yeah, like the more that I dug into this story, the more I realized that if I wanted to answer this question of what Filipino identity was under American rule, as a Filipino, the way that you look at it is through food. Because like all cultures, food is a way of expressing the flow of power, the identity that one is trying to reflect, and really the kind of image that one is trying to project in terms of sophistication, in terms of flourishing, and the kind of aspirations that one has. If you're a middle class person trying to present yourself as upper class, you eat a certain way. And that's where the American advertisements in the Philippines started to come in.
It just seems so interesting. Like, it sounds like there were these concerted, logical, rational business decisions about, oh, we need a trade entree, you know, create an empire. I'm not sure I 100% see the connection to this sort of culinary colonization. Like, where do you think that rationale began? Was it a business decision? Was it a government sort of imperialist, patriarchal thing that everything Filipino was bad? Where does that come
right.
from?
Great question. I think it's a combination of both the government and the business, but I think the driving force is really the way that people thought about eugenics in the 20th century. The way that there was a race-based structure in American society, and the way that the country looked at its role in foreign policy was based on elevating its new colonies. The term that was thrown around a lot by administrators, something called benevolent assimilation, that we were doing the right thing in assimilating people from Puerto Rico, people from Cuba, people from the Philippines, people from Hawaii, even Native Americans in the American West. Wherever there was an American flag, we were actually helping the people in those places by elevating them to an American form of culture. So the food is part of that. The imposition of the English language is part of that. Things like the Native American assimilation schools in Carlisle, Pennsylvania are part of that. And even like the argument goes that the importation of American agriculture and American cuisine to these different places to show them what was out there, that there was a better alternative supposedly than the indigenous cuisine that they've had the entire lives, was out there. This is probably a good point to bring in some of the narratives that were crafted in American advertising at this time. So like you would see things like canned foods and canned fruits were advertised as more healthy and higher nutrition. Because they were grown in California, packed in California with high fructose corn syrup, and then shipped across the world, 7,000 miles away. And supposedly that was healthier than fresh tropical fruits in the Philippines. And I just had some fresh Philippine mangoes today. It's way better than some, canned fruit cocktail that came out of Central California. Another thing was
not to mention they had to pay for it, right?
Yeah. And pay a premium because that's not cheap to import all the way around the world. But when I first started talking about this project with friends of mine, they would always say, "Oh, yeah, like American impact on Filipino food. You're talking about canned meat and spam," and like absolutely, that was an impact and result of the American occupation of the Philippines. But it also shows that like something like the foods that American soldiers were eating was something that was held in high esteem because it was something that was rare for Filipinos to have at the beginning. And it became something that was popular because it reflected their ability to Americanize their ability to understand how to prepare American goods. So to this day, the Philippines is one of the highest per capita consuming countries of spam because it was an American food that was held in high regard during those 46 years. Ice cream is also something that is promoted heavily during this time period. So American industry is building ice factories, basically to keep things like fish and fruit from perishing too quickly in that tropical heat. And along the way, ice cream becomes a popular food here in the United States. So Filipinos learning how to make ice cream becomes a fad the same way that today's like Cronut is in the United States. Like if you knew how to make ice cream, then it showed that you were up to date with the trends of the American colonizer. So you start to see like things like mango ice cream, purple yam ice cream, lychee ice cream flavors that are folding in tropical fruits. So there's an indigenization that's going on by Filipino companies using American techniques, but their advertisements are also claiming that ice cream is healthy for you, that ice cream makes your skin look better. And there's even an advertisement from 1927 that says ice cream makes your skin look whiter. So the whiteness narrative of trying to make Filipinos look and not only eat like Americans, but look like Americans becomes part of that colonial mentality as well.
That's just pretty amazing. Because you see that all over the world, but yeah. You know, to pair ice cream and this desire for lighter skin is just amazing. Tell us about some of the primary sources you were using. Yeah. You mentioned advertisements. What else did you use to do your research?
Right. So the old chef came back. I spent a lot of time looking at cookbooks, and I translated a bunch of cookbooks that were written in Tagalog Filipino language, a couple of cookbooks that were written in Spanish, and a couple of cooking pamphlets that were released by a bunch of these companies that were advertising in the United States, in the Philippines as well. So something like the Royal Baking Powder Company out of New York, I translated their cooking pamphlets over. I spent a lot of time looking at travel guides. So in an age before Lonely Planet, there were a couple of other travel guides that were based in the Philippines as well. And I looked at what kind of restaurants they were recommending travelers visit. And they were always talking about the French, the Italian, the German, and the Chinese restaurants that were in Manila, but they never once recommended eating Filipino cuisine in the Philippines. So that was another thing that jumped out at me. I spent a lot of time looking at menus. So I was looking at historical menus from the Philippines that were looking at my brain just froze. So I was looking at menus and looking at what foods were being profiled and prioritized in restaurants that were populated by the high class of the Philippines. So if you're a rich person, what kind of food were you eating when you're at the rich person's restaurant? And across the board, they weren't eating Filipino food. And not only were they not eating Filipino food, but they were trying their best to remove the Philippines from the representation within the menu. Oftentimes they would include the music that was being performed by the live orchestra that was performing at the same time as people were eating. And none of the musical selections included Filipino composers. It was always like light operas and American show tunes. And there was a whole lot of American ragtime in there, but very few of them ever included Filipino music. There were very few Filipino ingredients that were included in there. Like I almost expected that you wouldn't see any Filipino recipes, but the fact that they didn't even include Filipino ingredients outside of like the tobacco that was grown in Manila, that was never in the menus as well. And the last thing that I looked at were the, like an historian, like the initial accounts, the books, the letters, the pamphlets that were written by Americans that were living in the Philippines during that time period. And they basically are writing back home telling them, this is what we're doing while we're here. There's very little engagement with them saying, we're going into Filipino restaurants, we're going into Filipino markets. Instead, they talk about the importance of recreating the United States and the Philippines. So they talk about making their own recipes out in the Philippines, importing in American cookers and American appliances into the Philippines, and basically building an American expatriate community that wasn't all that different from the well-to-do in places like Long Island or New York, because they talk about how they want to make a Long Island and a New York in the Philippines.
But there was some kind of opposition to this at the time, right? Not everybody kind of accepted this right off the bat.
Yeah, there's a resistance, and that was one of the things that I talk about in the book as well. Part of the challenge in telling people that your food stinks is that people will be very defensive and say, no, our food is actually really good. And there's a lot of writing that says our food is based on, 300 years of exchange with the Spanish Empire, because the Spaniards were there before the Americans in 1521. You'll get a lot of people saying our food actually draws heavily from East Asia and from Indonesia and from the rest of Southeast Asia. It's a really good combination of all of them. And particularly among the elderly, older generations that weren't attending American schools, you'll get accounts of Filipinos saying there's no need for us to adapt. We're healthy. We're fine. And that's really the sticking point that American education from 1898 to 1946 is trying to combat. Like, how do you convince the older generations of Filipinos to start eating American food? And you see a paper trail of a lot of American educators saying, well, it's up to us to train the kids so the kids can convince the older generation. And once that happens, we'll start reaching out into public markets. We'll reach out into adult education. We'll try and find new ways of convincing older people to start adapting American foods. And that's why things like cookbooks and advertisements pick up where the schools left off. It's really an attempt to change all levels of society, regardless of race, class, religion, and age, to see American food as an expression of American power in the Philippines.
Well, I can't think of any more. There's no American food holiday that is more prevalent when we think about the history of American food than Thanksgiving. It centers around the meal, but the idea that there's so much there. And you and I are talking the week before Thanksgiving, and this is a year when probably more people than ever, given everything that's happened in 2020, recognize the problems with the typical cartoonish pilgrim Native American narrative. So I'm curious if you talk about Thanksgiving during your DWC course, and as a history professor teaching in the year of 2020, what are your thoughts about how we reflect on this holiday this year?
Yeah, no, I'm glad that you're asking this question, because this is actually one of my favorite lectures to deliver, because everyone's excited about Thanksgiving. And I like to send everyone home with the historical context of why that holiday is celebrated in the first place. And the pilgrim context from 1621 is definitely the one that we all grow up seeing, and the one that we think about, like the cartoonish cooperation that you mentioned. But I think, like, knowing the deeper history, the way that it emerges as a national holiday actually helps us understand its importance in 2020. And so forgive me as I go a little historian, but I pulled out two quotations I think were really important. The movement to make Thanksgiving into a holiday actually begins before the Civil War. It begins in 1827 with a New England author named Sarah Josepha Hale. And she wanted to make a holiday that celebrated the autumn before the dearth of the New England winter. So that's really where Thanksgiving emerged from. Like, we had to celebrate like one last autumnal harvest before we were in bleakness. And she wrote this in 1827 in one of her women's magazines. There's a deep moral influence in these periodical seasons of rejoicing in which a whole community participates. They bring out and together, as it were, the best sympathies of our nature. The rich contemplate the enjoyments of the poor with complacency, and the poor regard the entertainments of the rich without envy, because all are privileged to be happy in their own way. So she's trying to make an argument that regardless of race or class, Thanksgiving is a time to celebrate the fact that we're all gonna make it, that we made it through the fall, and the winter is coming, but we have to at least like pause to recognize that we've made it this far. And after 8 months of this pandemic, and as I hear my daughter crying in the room next to me, the fact that we're still alive, the fact that like that we're all pushing forward, I think that's something historically to relish in. After 1827, the the day becomes a national holiday in two different phases. In 1864, Lincoln makes it into a national holiday during an inflection point in the Civil War, specifically after Sherman's march to the sea and the capture of Georgia. And Lincoln makes it into a national holiday to basically say the Civil War is almost done. It's a year away from being done. It completes in April of 1865. And he makes the plea for Thanksgiving this way. I recommend to my fellow citizens that on that occasion, they do reverently humble themselves in the dust, from thence offer up penitent and fervent prayers and supplications to the great disposer of events for a return of the inestimable blessings of peace, union, and harmony throughout the land, which it has pleased him to assign as a dwelling place for ourselves and for our posterity throughout all generations. Peace, union, and harmony are things that we're all aspiring for, not only after the pandemic, but after like a really divisive election season. And the fact that Lincoln is writing this 160 years ago gives me hope that we'll be reading these same things 160 years from now, knowing that we survived yet another moment of American peril. The holiday becomes a national holiday officially in 1941, when FDR creates it in the midst of the Great Depression. You know, the US is about to enter the war in December 7th, a month later, right? But he's making a case that in the midst of the Great Depression, we need to be thankful for the fact that we've gotten through the pandemics of 1929, you know, the two waves of economic crashes by 1941, and the fact that the US had up until that point remained relatively separated from a conflict, from a world conflict. Of course, it's going to join the World War II right afterwards. But the fact that the holiday is solidified as something in American imagination during the Civil War and World War II, two really, you know, challenging inflection points in American history, gives me faith that, like, while we're not going to be able to have our grandparents over and not be able to have gatherings over 10, this holiday has always been about something along the narrative of bouncing back from something that's really, really tough. And it'll only make it that more special that this year, while hard, next year we'll be able to say, look, we came back again.
If we keep working, it's just, that's all we can do, right? Just continue. And but it's good to have a moment to express that gratitude and thankful for all we've achieved, however painful it might be. Well, when we come back to classes remotely after Thanksgiving, we'll be very close to marking Giving Tuesday on December 1st. And don't want to neglect the fact that, you know, in addition to all the work you're doing in the classroom, you're also the co-chair of PC's Faculty and Staff Giving Committee. Can you tell us why you joined and why this work is important to you?
Of course. When I was a college student, I worked my way through college, and I recognized that oftentimes the difference between learning and not learning was something as simple as whether or not you knew that you're financially secure, or whether or not you knew you're going to have enough money to buy your textbooks. And now that I'm on the opposite end, now that I'm the teacher, like, I see that same concern in a lot of my students' eyes. And I feel like in order to be a good servant of the PC community, I should always be trying to think empathetically about the needs of students. And far too many students are struggling financially, especially in this time. And this is my way of trying to contribute a solution to that very basic challenge that all of us are facing. Donating to the PC Giving Fund means that students that are that need our help the most have the resources, because we're just doing the right thing. So I've been a member of that committee for the last 3 years, and I consider it some of the most rewarding work that I do on campus. A lot of our work goes out anonymously, but knowing that so many people support it means that so many people are buying into the mission of the college and the mission that we have as educators and staff at the institution that we love.
Well, I think we could keep talking for quite a while, but we gotta call it at some point. Thank you so much for joining us today, Alex.
Of course, Liz. No, thank you very much for inviting me.
Subscribe to the Providence College Podcast in all the usual places, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you like what you hear, please review and share with others. Thanks for listening, and go Friars.